This is our outline that we're following from Baxter, and we are in the last major section, and we are dealing with chapter 19. So in this section, we have his apprehension, his prosecution, his crucifixion and entombment. This is how Baxter words it, and that's where we are in chapter 19. We're going to finish the trial of Jesus in just a moment. That's the first half of the chapter, not by number of verses, but the first section, and then we'll have his crucifixion. And that's what chapter 19 is about. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1, he's the true light. Chapter 2 deals with his power and authority. Chapter 3, somebody said something. Who was it? It was Nicodemus. Why do we flag Nicodemus this morning? Because he is mentioned in today's lesson. All right. And Nicodemus said he is a teacher come from God. Chapter 4, this message goes where? Samaritans and Galileans. Because he was questioned, he needs to call forth witnesses, and he does. Chapter 5. Chapter 6, he made a claim. He's the bread of life. Chapter 7, there was something that goes all through his ministry, but particularly started in Galilee. Controversy at the Feast of the Tabernacles. Chapter 8 ties with chapter 1. He is the true light that shines in a dark to a dark nation. Reminds us of the I've mentioned this several times. Taking a dark canvas and then painting a bright light on the midst of that dark canvas is what the Old Testament prophets did. All right. Chapter 9. Yeah, the healing of the blind man and the blind see and the seeing are blinded. Chapter 10, he makes a claim. He is good shepherd. Chapter 11, he is the resurrection and life. Chapter 12 is where we begin Passion Week, and that's his last trip to Jerusalem. We'll look at that on a calendar in just a moment. Chapter 13. Later in the week, we jump down to about Thursday of that week. What's going on? Washing the disciples' feet. And then in chapter 14, he comforts the disciples. Chapter 15, he talks about their relationships. Chapter 16, his final instructions. He gives the promise of the coming of the Holy Spirit and what's going to take place with him. And then chapter 17, he's still with the disciples. There's the prayer that's offered. Chapter 18, last time, he was betrayed and he was arrested and he's put on trial. All right. So let's talk about chapter 19. Chapter 19, I call it simply the crucifixion. Is that all that's there? No. There is the final hearing in the trial of Jesus. And we'll say more about that here in just a second. Verses 17 and 18 would seem to summarize what's going on here in chapter 19. He took the cross, bearing the cross, took it off to Golgotha, and there they crucified him. This is what chapter 19 is about. Two things happen in chapter 19. We have Pilate delivered Jesus for death, verses 1 to 16. Then we have the death of Jesus. We have his burial, and that's where we leave him. So let's see where we are on our Passion Week calendar. Chapter 12 was on Sunday, his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And so John doesn't touch on the Monday or the much about the events on Tuesday or Wednesday. Luke does, is the only one that may touch on Wednesday. And we've talked about that when we came through Luke. So he jumps over from Sunday to Thursday, and that's where the observance of the Passover is, the farewell to the disciples. So John chapters 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17 all take place on that Thursday. Make sense? Goes to the Garden of Gethsemane, he prays, which is not all in detail in John, and then that's where he was betrayed and he was arrested in the early hour morning of Friday. And so this is where his trial takes place, and this is where his crucifixion takes place, and that's where they place him in the tomb. And then we have no record of Saturday except he was in the tomb. It was a day in the tomb. And then next week, chapter 20, we're going to get into the resurrection. And so we jump to that Sunday. Make sense? So we've covered a week from chapter 12 to chapter 20. And that's what I want you to see. All right. So let's talk about the Pilate delivering Jesus for death. I mentioned last week that this is the last time for a while that we're going to be seeing the breakdown of the trial of Jesus, because we looked at that in Matthew, we looked at it in Mark, we looked at it in Luke, and this is the final aspect of the trial in John. We may make reference in sermons, but we're not going to be dealing with it in classes for a little while. So we're about done with that. So I mentioned one more time that the trial consisted of a Jewish trial and a Roman trial, two major trials, three hearings each. John doesn't mention every one of these. John only mentions the first, the fourth, and the sixth. Does that make sense? He talks about him going before Annas. Why did they take him before Annas? He's not high priest. He was the former high priest. They still recognized him as their high priest because the Romans had deposed him. But they need to take him before the real high priest in the eyes of the Romans and before the Sanhedrin so that the Romans are willing to execute the judgment. Does that make sense to you? So then they take him before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin again. John doesn't mention that. He jumps from Annas to Pilate, number four, which is number one under the Roman trial. So you see that in John chapter 18. So if you just read John and didn't know the breakdown of all the synoptics and how this all broke down, we might think this was all one trial, one hearing. But we know from Luke that Pilate sent him over to Herod, and then Herod sends him back. So we are at the last, at the sixth of the hearings is where we are. And I want us to back up now and pick up at verse 39, just briefly. Verse 39 and 40, which we covered last week, is part of this sixth hearing. Everything else about Pilate in John 18 was the fourth hearing. And he's been off to Herod, and now he's come back, beginning at verse 39. And so verse 39 and 40, we'll get to in just a moment. He wanted to release the king of the Jews, and they said, no, not we don't want to release him. We want to release Barabbas. That's 39 and 40. And then we pick up with chapter 19, verse 1. All right. Now, this is a summary of combining Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And I just want to run through this, and then we're going to go to the text. Does that make sense? So there's going to be some things here that you're not going to see in John because we're pulling that out of Matthew or we're pulling it from Mark or pulling it from Luke. But this is a compilation of what we have in all the synoptics. This is the final hearing. This is about 6 or 6:30 in the morning. And this is the final one. And so Pilate says, I don't find any fault with him. He's already had a trial with Pilate. This is the second one. And Pilate presents Jesus, says, behold the man. We'll see that in a moment. And Pilate again says, I find no fault with him. The Jews said, we have a law, he ought to die. And Pilate asked, well, where are you from? He heard something about him being the Son of God. And then Pilate wanted to release Jesus, and they threatened, saying, well, you wouldn't be Caesar's friend. Pilate wants to release him, but his wife, now John didn't tell us this, but his wife had told him, I've had some dreams about this. And I've suffered in dreams because of this man. We'll talk about that in a moment. And the people said, no, release Barabbas. And, well, what fault has he done? And what do you want me to do with the Christ? And they said, crucify him. Well, what evil has he done? They never give an answer. He washes his hands, symbolizing, I'm innocent in this. And then Pilate presents Jesus, said, behold your king. He scourged him. And then here you go, y'all, let him be crucified. And that's it. Sham of a trial, as every one of the hearings were. All right, now let's get underway with what John tells us. We'll pull in some things from Matthew here in just a moment, perhaps. So let's get underway here. Question number two, what questions did Pilate ask here in this text? Now, he's asked others previously. What does he ask here? Where are you from? Verse 9. Are you not speaking to me? Verse 10. And do you not know that I have power and authority? Verse 10. All right. Let's see what happens here. Pilate scourged him, and he and the people mocked Jesus. So notice verse 1. So Pilate took Jesus, after they said, release unto us Barabbas, and he scourged him. I think perhaps he's wondering. It seems, let me just footnote here. It seems like Pilate is between a rock and a hard place. Pilate has no real affection for Jesus. He has no real affection for the Jews either. And he's in a rock and a hard place. They've brought a man to him he doesn't know what to do with. But he wants to satisfy the people. But he also recognizes, I find no fault with him. And so he seems to think, if I scourge him, maybe they'll feel sorry for him and think that's enough punishment, and I'll release Barabbas, and then here we go. Not so. So the text says he took him and he scourged him. Now, what was involved in scourging? Scourging would involve taking a whip, something like you have pictured here from one of the Bible dictionaries. They would often put fragments of bone or stone or some kind of metal object so that they would, as they whip the person, and they would pull that back so that it cuts, and as one writer suggested, it flays the back open. They'd often have them stand around a post, so they tighten the back, and so consequently when they're whipping, they would just fillet the back open. Often they would pass out, sometimes they would even die. Profuse bleeding. Their eyes sometimes would be put out by the stone or the bone coming around and hitting them in the eye. And so they're often left almost lifeless, and he scourged Jesus. As if that's not enough, there's more that develops. Verse 2, what do? They put a crown of thorns on his head. What's that about? It's in mockery and derision. You claim to be king of the Jews? We'll give you a crown. See what this crown feels like. And so they put that on him, and they put on him a purple robe. You claim to be king? There's your robe, you king. And then they mock him, saying at verse 3, "Hail, King of the Jews." And then they struck him with their hands. And so they're mocking and ridiculing, humiliating him in every way, in shape and form. Now, beginning at verse 4, we find that Pilate finds no fault with him. He said, "Behold, I'm bringing him out to you, and that you know that I find no fault with him." In other words, there's any charge that's been brought, there is no evidence of wrongdoing. There is no evidence of violating the law. There's no evidence that he is trying to raise an insurrection against Caesar. There's no evidence of that. I find no fault with him. So then Jesus came out, verse 5, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. He's already been beaten. So he's a pitiful, humiliated he doesn't stand there like a proud king. He's standing there, having been beaten, and Pilate says to them, "Behold the man." The commentators have taken their stab at what that means, and they're varied in that, but in essence, when they all get through, they're all, the ones at least that I've read, come close together of hitting at what he was trying to accomplish. Would suggest that he's appealing to their better nature. In other words, look at this man. Just take a look at this man. This man that we've humiliated with this robe and the crown, and he's been beaten, he's bleeding from the scourging. And perhaps, as some have suggested, that he's saying, as Willis suggests, look at this beaten, pitiful man. He is no threat to you or to Caesar. And perhaps making an appeal, he's the one we need to release. Doesn't say that, but it seems like he's trying to make an appeal. Behold the man. Look at this man. He's no threat to you. It doesn't work because he's appealing to people that have no use for Jesus or Pilate either. But when they heard that, verse 6, what'd they say? Crucify him. Crucify him. And he said, "You crucify him. I find no fault with him." Do you see some frustration on the part of Pilate? They bring charges, but they have no real evidence. He needs to be crucified. Well, we wouldn't have brought him if he wasn't evil. So they really don't make any kind of sense of the trial. And then he makes an appeal to them, seemingly to their better nature, which there is no better nature with the reference to them. And he's frustrated. "You go crucify him." Well, they can't do that. It has to be done by the Romans. So beginning at verse 8 now, he comes before Pilate again. Well, let's get verse 7. They said, "We have a law that according to our law, a man ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." Now, a lot just happened in verse 7. What law would they be appealing to? "We have a law." They're talking about the Old Testament law. Possibly. I wonder if they're not thinking about, it's not quoted here, I wonder if they're not thinking about, and this is just one sampling, Leviticus 24 and verse 16, that a blasphemer was to be stoned to death. And if he's not the Son of God, and he's claiming to be the Son of God, then he is guilty of blasphemy. That is blasphemy. Because the expression, the Son of God, we saw in John 5, means I claim to be God. And if he's saying, I'm deity, I'm God, and he's not, then he's guilty of blasphemy. He ought to die. But it wasn't just a claim. There was evidence, and he was the Son of God. So they said, we have a law. And our law says, a man guilty of blasphemy, and I'm paraphrasing, ought to die. And so he needs to be crucified. It's what needs to happen. But notice what they just said to Pilate. They had been saying he claims to be king of the Jews. They're trying to appeal. He's trying to be a threat to Caesar. And so you want to take care of this man because that's a political threat to you and to him and to the nation. So they're, whether he was playing to be king or not, they're just playing a political game there. And they hadn't mentioned much about this thus far. But when they said he makes himself the Son of God, he claims to be deity. Look at verse 8 now. When Pilate heard this, what was his reaction? He was more afraid. He's already got some fear, but he's more afraid this time. Why is that? Well, this is not an ordinary prisoner. He's not had one like this in his court before. This is a unique prisoner. His wife had said this. John doesn't tell us, but we know this to be true from Matthew. His wife said, I've had dreams because of this man. I've suffered in dreams. And could it have been an ordinary dream? Sure, but it very well may have been a miracle that God had caused her to have these dreams for her to tell Pilate. And so she's telling her husband, don't have anything to do with this man. I've had some terrible dreams about us dealing with this man. You just let him go. Have nothing to do with him. He may be thinking about that. Well, they just made the claim. He says he's God. And then you got to wonder, and I hadn't thought much about this, to someone, some writer made this observation, that Pilate might be wondering, suppose he is who he claims to be. What then? What then? Something made Pilate afraid. And perhaps that's part of the driving force, for I want to make a point from verse 14, 15, and 19 later. He seems to want to gig the Jews a little bit. And agitate them a little bit, and I don't blame him. They deserve that. But anyway, that's another story. All right. Now, beginning here at verse 8, so Pilate then comes in and asks him, where are you from? I don't think that's what's your address? Could you give me, you know, do you live in Jerusalem? Do you live on the south side of Jerusalem? That's not what he, where are you from? What's he asking? I'm not sure. One writer suggests the Romans believed in mythology and thought the gods came bringing vengeance. Now, wait a minute. If you claim to be the Son of God, you might be some god, and you may bring vengeance. Tell me where you're from. I'd like to know a little more about who you are. I don't know. I'm seeing more this time. Maybe you've seen this always, but I'm seeing in John this time a greater picture of Pilate's dilemma than I've seen before. No. It's a mob, it's a crowd, and he's got to deal with that, but then he's got to deal with the fact there's no evidence, and they just made a claim. He says he's God. Now, wait a minute. Where are you from? That was a powerful question. I want to know more. What's this all about? So Jesus answered and said, verse 10, Pilate said, are you not, Jesus didn't answer him, first of all, didn't say a word. Are you not going to speak to me? Do you not know I have power to crucify you and the power to release you? I'm the one sitting here with power, and how does Jesus respond? Yeah, and I learned a very practical, all government, listen to that carefully. All government has power from God. In other words, what I mean by that, there is no power unless God lets them have power. In other words, the government doesn't have power over God. There's no way. So any power, authority that government has is because God allows them to have that. And so Jesus corrects that and said, no, you don't have any power unless it be given to me. Therefore, the one who delivered you me to you has the greater sin. Now that's caused some consternation a little bit. I think what he's saying is, while you were guilty, the real problem here is the chief priest and the scribes, the leaders among the Jews, because they had every opportunity to know. They had Moses and the prophets. They went to the synagogue. They had the reading of the law, the reading of the prophets. They knew. So they have the greater responsibility because they should know better. You may not know any better, Pilate. And so, yes, you're guilty, but I'm going to tell you, the real problem here is the Jews. They have the greater sin. I don't think he's grading sin. This is a greater sin than this one. I don't know of any text that talks about sins being one more important or worse than another. So from that point, he sought to release him, but the Jews cried out and said, if you let him go, what's the point here? You're Caesar's friend. And so they make that a political appeal again. You're going to be in trouble with Caesar if you let this guy go. All right, let's start at verse 13 now and work through verse 16 to finish this up. Pilate basically here in 13 to 16 delivers him to the Jews. Y'all, you want to crucify him, you crucify him. But this is quite interesting. Pilate therefore heard that saying, and he brought Jesus out and he sat in the judgment seat. All right, this is where he executes the judgment and pronounces judgment. It's also called the pavement. That's because of the mosaic design of the floor, I understand. But in Hebrew, it was called Gabbatha, which means elevated. Elevated seat from which he executed judgment. That's all it means. He sits basically where he executes his judgment. Now, this was the preparation day of the Passover. Now, you might flag verse 31 because this is the preparation day before the Sabbath. So that tells me this is on, we had it on our calendar a moment ago. That's how we know. This is on Friday. That's the preparation for the Sabbath. So tie verse 14 to verse 31, if you will. Helps you a little bit on the term Passover here, I think, is used in the sense of the... Sometimes it has reference to the meal itself, and then sometimes it has reference to the whole feast, the eight-day feast. And I think here it has reference to the eight-day feast. Now, I think Roman time is being used here. This was about the sixth hour. There's some references where Jewish time started at 6 o'clock, so the third hour of the day would be 9 o'clock, or the sixth hour of the day would be noon. But Romans started, as we do, at midnight, so the sixth hour would be about 6 a.m. This is the early hours of the morning. Make sense? So that gives you a little time frame of what's going on. Now, verse 14, he said to them, this was about the sixth hour, when he pronounces his judgment, he said, behold, your king. Now, their charge was he claims to be king. They don't like this concept of him being king, but it seems to me he's gigging them a little bit. Here's the one that claimed to be your king. That's not what he said. Behold your king. Seems to me y'all put me in a dilemma. Y'all put me between a rock and a hard place. Y'all have caused me some consternation. Here's your king, knowing they'd hate that. Well, he's not through with that. He's going to do that again at verse 15. You'll see it again at verse 19 in a minute. So look at verse 15. And they cried, away with him, away with him. And Pilate said, shall I crucify your king? Gigs him again. Is that what you want me to take your king and kill him? Pilate's in a rock and a hard place, I want to tell you. And they say, we have no king but Caesar. So he delivered it to their will. I think that's the point of verse 16. He delivered them not for them to go, because the Romans are the ones going to crucify him. Delivered it to them, I think, is delivered him to their will. You want him crucified, y'all take him off. And the Romans will execute him, but y'all go do that. All right, make sense? Now, let's get ahead of ourselves. I want to jump ahead to verse 19. He gigs him one more time. So verse 14, 15, and verse 19, when he then puts him on the cross, he puts a sign up that says, Jesus, who claimed to be king of the Jews, right? No, Jesus, king of the Jews. They didn't like that. It seems to me that he's got a little bit of I'm going to gig them. They put me in this spot. Maybe he didn't. But it sure got in their craw, I want to tell you. And he seems to be digging at them. Can you blame him? All right. Questions? Comments? Let's go to the crucifixion now. And we have the crucifixion here in 17 to 22. So Jesus bore his cross to Golgotha. We flagged this a little more in detail in Luke. So if you're listening online or if y'all want to go back and look at our YouTube on Luke 22, chapter 23, we'll have a little more details. But anyway, Golgotha is right here. It's thought to be, and that's generally where it's confirmed to be even in the present day in relationship to the city of Jerusalem. All right, he bore his cross. Now, what's not mentioned here is he didn't carry his cross all the way because he couldn't carry it all. So what happened? Simon of Cyrene bore his cross for him. And they come out to the place of the skull called Golgotha. Calvary was a Latin term. Golgotha is a Hebrew term. The place of the skull where they crucified him. And they crucified him between two thieves, one on each side, and Jesus in the center. And then Pilate wrote this title before him. This was customary to have a name in the charge. So if a man was guilty of murder, it's John Doe, and murder is his charge. And that's why, so if you come by, well, reckon why they crucified him. He stole, he murdered, and Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. How many languages did he write it in? In three. Latin was the Roman language of the court. So it was the official documentation language. Hebrew was the common language of the people. Greek was the worldwide language, as English may be in our day, that communicates to the world. And so in case anybody wants to read it from wherever they may be from, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. You can read it in Greek, Latin, or in Hebrew. Common people can see it, the commerce people can see it, and the legal people can read it. All right? And so they didn't like that. I told you they was gigging them because they said, no, don't write King of the Jews, but that he said, I'm King of the Jews. There's a distinction. Put up there that he claimed, not that he is, but they claimed. And what was Pilate's reaction? I've written. In other words, it's final, it's over, it's done. We don't talk about that anymore. All right. What happens in 23 and 24 now? Yeah, they cast lots for his garments. Now, you think of how low people become. They've already scourged him, ridiculed him, slapped him, beat him, and they put him on the cross as an innocent man and crucify him. And then down at the cross, Jesus has to look down and see people scurrying around wanting a piece of his garments. Now, I thought about that this morning, that let's put that in a modern setting. A man's about to be put in the electric chair, and if the media caught some of the state officials, some of the officers taking his garment, as soon as he's electrocuted, they start ripping part of his clothes and separating them and dividing them, and they caught that on camera. What would the media do with that? And this guy may be a criminal. We know he's a criminal. He's an admitted criminal. He's murdered hundreds of people, and we're executing him, and they're wanting his garments. Oh, how terrible and disrespectful for human life. And down at the foot of the cross, you have them ripping and tearing his garments, but then there was a tunic. What's so special about the tunic? And so, since they didn't want to rip and tear it, they cast lots for it. It's just a game of chance, rolling, much like rolling dice. Maybe a knuckle bone or something like that, that how it turns up, it's a game of chance. And so they basically roll the dice for who gets what. And so that fulfilled, verse 24, Psalm 22:18, they divided my garments among them, my clothing they cast lots. And therefore the soldiers did these things. Here they're fulfilling prophecy and don't have a clue of what they are doing. Questions or comments thus far? All right. Let's see if we can get through the text. 25 to 27, Jesus commends his mother into John's care. This we'll go through quickly. We've got a question number four. What three statements did Jesus make on the cross? Three are mentioned in this text. You may have counted it as four. Generally, verse 26 and 27 is counted as one. There are actually seven statements on the cross. Three are mentioned here. So if you want to divide those two, then you have to have eight. But be that as it may, I'll leave you to do that for yourself. But anyway, Jesus, there stood by the cross. There are four people mentioned. Some think it was three. I think there are four because that's what the text mentions. His mother is there, whose name is Mary. Her sister, who's not named here, but her name was Salome. Then there's another Mary, the wife of Cleopas. And then there's Mary Magdalene. And Jesus looks down to the disciple that Jesus loved. Who is that? Probably John. Do I know 100%? No. But it is generally thought to be John, the author of the book. Because one of the arguments for it being John is John never mentions himself in that regard. I mean, he doesn't mention himself, but he refers to a disciple that Jesus loved. So it's thought to be the author of the book. And so you have Peter, James, and John who had that inner circle with Jesus. And among those, John had the closer relationship with Jesus. Doesn't mean he didn't love others. It meant there was a special relationship. You've got friends like that. You have friends that are closer than other friends. And then of those close friends, you may have some that are closer than others. And so Jesus did too. The person that says, I treat everybody alike. You're lying. You don't do that. Jesus didn't. I don't mean to accuse you of lying, but you're lying. You don't treat everybody alike. We all have an inner circle that we are closer to than someone else. Jesus did. Anyway, that's another story. Beginning at verse 26, what does he say? In other words, he's talking about, look here to John, and he is going to be as your son. I know that's what he's talking about because of verse 27. He turns then to that disciple and he says, behold your mother. In other words, mom, this is your son. John, this is your mother. Not literally your son, literally your mother. And from that hour, that disciple took her to his own home. Now, that expression, own home, may suggest that John had some degree of wealth. Because to own your own home in this day and time means the bank has loaned you some money. That's all that means. You may be poor as Job's turkey and you own a home. But not in biblical times. If you owned the home, there was some degree of wealth. I don't mean you were mega wealthy like John, but you had some degree of wealth. May suggest John had a little money. And so anyway, he's able to take care of the mother. All right, let's move on in interest of time. Jesus then dies. Jesus, knowing all things would be were now accomplished. And I want to jump ahead. And later at verse 30, he says, it is finished. I think that accomplished and it is finished are connected together. We'll come back to that. But the first thing he says here, which is actually the second of the ones recorded here, that the scriptures might be fulfilled, he said, I thirst. And there was a vessel of sour wine sitting there. They filled the sponge. And they put it on hyssop and put it up to his mouth. There's a couple things I learned from that. That's probably not the same thing that was mentioned in Matthew 27 and in verse 34 and Mark 15, 23. That wine he refused. That had gall and it was bitter. This he accepted because the text says when he had received the sour wine, he said it is finished. So I think they're two distinct things. That's number one. The second thing is putting it upon a hyssop pole may give us some implication how far up Jesus was. A hyssop branch would not be over a foot and a half to 3 foot, so it's not like a 10-foot pole. But at the longest, maybe 3 foot, so maybe just strike the median between 1.5 and 2, so it's like 2 3/4, so say 2 feet. And they were able to take that and reach him at his mouth, so that tells you that he wasn't way up high, but he was within reach of a 2 foot stick. For what that may be worth. I don't know what edification you get out of that. That's just kind of interesting. So then he said, it is finished. You think of that. I came to do my work. I came to do everything. And the ultimate mission was to die for the sins of mankind. And now he's ready to do that. And then the text says, he gave up the ghost. Which means he gave up his spirit. He's now dead. Now, I quickly want to mention a couple things because our time is running out. His side was pierced. They come around being the preparation day and they start breaking the legs to speed up death, which tells me you die by suffocation. And so they break the legs, they sink down, they can't raise up to exhale, so they die by suffocation. Jesus had already died by suffocation, so they didn't break his legs, and that fulfilled prophecy. And then a soldier pierced his side, and there came out blood and water. Verse 34. You might check King's work, Daniel H. King's work on John. He explores a little bit about some of the medical things and references that more than exploring it himself. I think the point of that is that that establishes the reality of his death. He didn't just lose some blood and faint, but it establishes for all present and for us that he really died. That not only did blood came out, but by the time water comes out, that tells that he's expired, he's dead. It's an affirmation of that. So I won't go into some of the medical, I don't have time to do that. And then verse 35, John comments, I'm telling you this so that you might believe. In other words, I was an eyewitness. I saw that. I was standing there. I saw blood and water came out. He died. He really died. He's dead. No doubt about that. So now there's the burial of Jesus. And I want to flag something here. Let's go quickly through the story. Joseph of Arimathea. Arimathea is about 20 miles northwest of Jerusalem. So he's not far away. Joseph of Arimathea was a secret disciple. Get ready to flag something about that here in a minute, if you wish. And he had some help from Nicodemus. We saw Nicodemus in chapter 3, came to Jesus by night. We saw him in chapter 7. He's a member of the Sanhedrin court, defended Jesus, and he tried to reason with them. And now we have him here going and helping with the preparation of the body, and they prepare the body for burial. And they take it to a new tomb where there's not been a body. It's been hewn out, solid rock. And there they place him, and that's where we're going to leave him. Now, let's get ready to flag. Our time's gone. I want to flag a couple of things here that I find quite interesting. The tomb was very close by, and then the next scene is going to be 2 days later. That's on Friday. On Sunday, then, we have him raised from the dead. All right. This is a question I've got, and you may have heard me mention this before, and you may have this flag. Get ready at verse 39. Joseph of Arimathea was a secret disciple for fear of the Jews. He was fearful of the Jews. So he was a follower. He believed in Jesus, but he kind of held back a little bit. See that? Now look at Nicodemus. He came to Jesus by night. And all I'm going to do is raise a question because I don't know the answer to this. Are those parallel phrases? Could that be giving me a commentary on why he came? We often say he came to Jesus by night. We don't know why. You're right, we don't know why. But I'm wondering, what was John implying? There was two disciples. Here was Joseph, who was a secret disciple. And then there was Nicodemus, who first came to Jesus by night. Could those be parallel phrases? That he was a secret disciple. He defended Jesus. He came to Jesus by night. And admitted, no one does the miracles that you do unless God be with you. Remember that? If I had to be on a jury and vote, I think those are parallel. Maybe not. I'll leave that for you to decide. We're done.